Hi, in this episode of IB Matters, we talked to author Jason Ablin. His book, The Gender Equation in Schools, How to Create Equity and Fairness for All Students, will be published in June 2022 and features many tools for teachers to use in beginning to create classrooms where all students feel empowered to be their best selves. Please listen as Jason shares some of these tools and we hear stories of how he has worked with schools around the world on gender-aware teaching practices. Welcome to IB Matters, a podcast for those who currently teach, lead, attend, or are interested in International Baccalaureate IB schools. Well, hi, folks. Welcome back to IB Matters. And today we've got a special treat for you, something a little different from our usual. We're not talking to an IB coordinator or an IB teacher. We're talking with an author, Jason Ablin, who was brought to us by one of our past guests, Bhavna Matthew, who's recommended his work to us. And I've been reading this book that he has just coming out. Is it this week, Jason, that it's coming out?
The book gets released on June 16th.
Okay. So about a month away, actually, almost from the book release. But he's got a great website with chapter summaries. And as I was reading through them, I think you're going to find it really interesting. The book is called The Gender Equation in Schools, How to Create Equity and Fairness for All Students. And as I kind of perused this at a very upper atmosphere level, it is really interesting to see where this goes. And I'm really fascinated to talk with Jason about this today. So Jason, welcome to the podcast. And why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourself, tell people a little bit about your background.
So thank you, John. And thank you for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure. I have had some interactions with IB schools and I just love the program in general. I'm a big fan. So it's a real pleasure being on your show. So I was a teacher, a department chair, a principal, a head of school in Los Angeles, in private schools, actually, in Los Angeles. And for the past 5 or 6 years, I've been working as a consultant. And two specific areas I work in are creating faculty culture, working with schools on their faculty culture to create really great working environments. And that involves the administration as well, not just the teachers. And the other area I work on is creating really gender-aware campuses where both students, teachers, administrators, and parents as well can feel like they're having one conversation around gender inside of their schools. I've been doing those for about 10 years now, and finally it culminated with me saying, you know, it would be maybe be a good idea if I sat down and wrote a book about this.
Yeah.
And I did. And that only took me 4.5 years, John, to write that book.
That's all. Okay. Well,
that's all. Yeah.
Congrats.
It's a labor. Thank you. Really a labor. I'm very excited about it coming out. And as I mentioned, John, to you earlier, you know, the purpose of this gender conversation is to create environments at schools where kids can be more successful. The gender conversation for me is about making better schools. And I think that sometimes in our current climate, particularly politically, that gets lost in the conversation when we're talking about places that feel fair to students, places that feel where everyone can feel included, that everyone's identity can be validated. And therefore, it's going to be a greater and more successful environment for students to go to school. And so a lot of the book is really, tries to move the reader, faculty members, teachers, communities towards that end with gender.
So one of the things, and obviously, as you're well aware, the current political climate that you referred to briefly there, it seems really prickly around the term gender. And so do you feel like in reading this book, if you can get people from all sides to open the cover, that they would all, people would learn something that would be useful?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what I tried to do was focus on some really key aspects of research in this area. So that there was some ground underneath the work that was being discussed in this book. I don't talk about equity in the larger sense. I actually go into details about teacher practices, about student behaviors, about policies and procedures that schools have in place that can create inequitable environments and what you can do to fix those. And also what schools can do in general to create classrooms which are more equitable based on data and research. So teachers, you know, schools feel like they have something to hang their hat on when they read the book.
Let me start with a question that we shared earlier, which is, you know, when you look at a school's focus on gender, how does that, you know, you mentioned it gives a better education for all students. How does a focus on gender actually accomplish that?
Another great question. Thank you. So I'm going to just give you a couple really stark examples, and I hope that they can illustrate what this conversation is, because I've had this conversation with faculties in schools that are very quote unquote woke. And I've had this conversation with schools that, you know, they're just interested in having this conversation and they feel like they need someplace to start. Right. So in elementary schools, there's a perfect example of walking into teachers' classrooms. And one of the things that we know is that over 90%, closer to 95% of teachers in elementary school environments are women. And when you walk into their classrooms and you take photographs of the walls of their classroom and the environments which they create at the beginning of the year, Jen, which if you know, you know, elementary school teachers, they spend hours at the beginning of the year.
Days. They will come in. They will come in. They'll come in two unpaid days before teacher workshops to make sure the rooms are ready for their colleagues to see, not even for the kids. That's
exactly.
One of my daughters is a teacher, and at one time was elementary music, and it was, you know, that's exactly what I witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're there till 10 o'clock at night, like you're walking around the building, and they're just so, you know, they invest so much effort and love into this classroom.
I was just going to use that word, love, exactly.
It is. It's a form of love that they're doing when they create these classroom spaces. And then I come in and to have this discussion about gender, and I go around the classrooms, I'll take photographs of the classrooms, and we'll do a walk around, and we'll also do a data crunch. On what I've seen in the classrooms. And invariably in these schools, what you'll find is approximately 80% of what's on the walls is language acquisition. It's about, you know, literacy skills, English acquisitions, English projects. About 10% are kind of inspirational sayings and, you know, posters of people who have said important things. Then you'll get about 5% that looks like science and history. And about 5% that represents math education at the school. And when we walk that back and we take a look at what that means by the design of the classrooms, the teachers are sending extremely powerful messages to the students about what matters in their education. And if you ask the teachers, how important is mathematics education to the students? They say, oh, we spend about 40%, 50% of our time on mathematics. And then we have to unpack, well, why don't you think that's represented in the very way in which you think about your classes and design these classrooms? And then we start talking about their own personal experiences as learners, people who went through school themselves, and many of them talk about their own insecurities and difficulties as math students when they were growing up in school, that then get perpetuated into their teaching practices when they get into the profession. And that's just one example. That's just really one example, a simple one where I can come in and kind of make significant change in the school environment. And I provide some of those tools in the book.
So how does that tie back to gender? Is that because are you tying it to the kind of the gender, the focus on male versus female in mathematics? Is that kind of what the issue is?
Yes, it is. And one of the things I talk about in there is some of the cognitive neuroscience research that I was also involved in my career. And we talk about this, you know, the discovery about 25 years ago about something called mirror neurons, right? So when a female teacher is standing in front of a classroom and she is expressing, let's say, just for an example, math anxiety, she might be teaching it. And she might be doing what she's supposed to be doing and going along with the curriculum. But at the same time, there is literally a passing on of anxiety about math education from this teacher to her female students. Mm-hmm. And they are getting very powerful messages about what they how they identify as learners mm-hmm. inside the classroom. The boys, of course, are somewhat disassociated from that because they don't make their primary associations necessarily with a female teacher. So they can disassociate themselves from that connection, that strong mm-hmm. connection. One of the things I talk about, though, is often that the exact opposite happens for boys, and we know this is struggles they have with literacy education, is that they don't see a place for themselves often in literacy education because it seems like it's something that should be part of a feminine construct rather than a masculine construct.
Okay.
So that classroom really is just, it's there is so much energy inside the classroom around gender. Mm-hmm. That we really need to become much more aware of when we're creating spaces, when we're thinking about how we're presenting material, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is there a corollary in the reverse? You mentioned the fact that the boys see the feminine construct around language learning, but is there also a corollary where in which, because you mentioned that in elementary schools, obviously there's a majority of female teachers. When you end up having male teachers that sprinkle in elementary and become more common in the older grades, do they have similar issues with how they present information they're more comfortable with?
Yes. And one of the interesting things, there have been a number of studies around this, which is really fascinating, which is the argument this problem would be solved, right? We'd have more boys being able to identify with learning, such as in areas like literacy, because they have male teachers. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't necessarily played itself out. That is not necessarily a direct causal relationship between those two things. What we do see often is that males carry into a lot of these spaces also inequitable practices when they also have girls inside of their math classes, inside of their science classes. And that's something also that male teachers have to be really cognizant and aware of when they're in those environments as well. Mm-hmm. One of the big things that I talk a lot about in the book is how in the last 50 or 60 years, you know, women they've bought into school as a place where really they can excel in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, their numbers are through the roof. They're graduating high school and college at accelerated rates, master's right. programs. 2 years ago, the numbers in the United States flipped, where more women were graduating from medical school for the first right. time in this country right. than males were. And the exact opposite is happening for men. Mm-hmm. They are dropping out of school at accelerated rates. They're not finishing programs. They're not finishing their education. And one of the things I talk about in the book is really recalibrating our lens on this very word gender mm-hmm. to make sure that we don't see it just as a feminist issue or as an issue revolving around the LGBTQ community. But we need to include our boys in this conversation and about the way that they're relating to school.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a listener, as someone listening to us talking so far might be going, well, it sounds, you know, there are terms in here and you're talking about this being research-based, but there's also a lot of kind of traditional stereotypes that are built in. And I know that you have, you know, a chapter or two of your book that kind of addresses some of this. But when you talk about these stereotypes, it can be dangerous sometimes, I would think. I would assume that when you go into some schools, you have a certain amount of folded arms and skeptical looks, if not more skeptical comments right. and things that come into play here. Talk about that, because let's address that, because I'm sure some listeners are going to be going, well, wait a minute. These two men are talking about women teachers in almost stereotypical ways. So let's defend that or talk about how you address that.
Well, again, and a lot of it has to do with the research presented. I don't do the talking. I let much more sophisticated academics and researchers do the talking about what these how these issues speak to education. I do understand that when I walk into a school to begin working with a faculty on this, the last place I want to do is make assumptions about what people think about gender. Mm-hmm. So one of the first places I start is just having open conversations about what people think within the school community about gender in general. Mm-hmm. And that's from a very personal place. I try to make it as personal but non-threatening as possible, because I want people to understand that everybody has gender stories. Everybody's got a gender narrative, something they remember from school, from growing up, something that really speaks to them. And that's where the conversation begins. Mm-hmm. And once we begin having those conversations, then I think we can start getting to the way that the school community looks and what they notice inside of their own school communities about these issues. That to me is a very powerful foundation that's got to be laid down when you begin these conversations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what are some of the things that you do specifically to help teachers improve their practice on being, you know, you use the term being gender aware educators. What are some of the tools and approaches that you have found and maybe that you do in your consulting work?
So one of the areas that I try to focus the most on with teachers is the question of engagement with students. Early childhood educators, which is an interesting group to work with because they're working with 3-year-olds, you know, mm-hmm. 4-year-olds.
Right, right.
And one of the things we talk a lot about is about the process of listening and speaking inside of classrooms. So one of the research studies I show, and then I actually reproduced it on my own in early childhood environments, was that I went in there and I found that a majority of teachers, 98% of early childhood educators were women, and the majority of them were allowing boys to interrupt them on a 2-to-1 basis. So if the teacher was speaking, they allowed boys to interrupt them in mid-thought, even though they were in the process of speaking. Hmm. With the girls, the exact opposite was the case. The teachers were 2-to-1 more likly to interrupt their girl students when they were speaking. They're already, by the time these kids are 3 or 4 years old, setting up paradigms for engagement inside of classrooms and what to expect, right? So fast forward to when these kids are in third grade and fourth grade, and all of a sudden you've got these very frustrated teachers sometimes who don't know how to, quote unquote, handle boys in their classroom. Mm-hmm. Well, the boys have just spent the last 5 or 6 years inside of classrooms being told that it's totally okay and acceptable if they assert themselves in inappropriate ways. And then some teacher comes along and is like pulling her hair out because she can't handle the boys in her class or feels like there's discipline issues, quote unquote, discipline issues. So we talk about the patterns of engagement, the kinds of questions that they're asking different types of students. Where are they spending most of their time and energy? Are they ignoring the girls in their class because the girls are being obedient, mm-hmm. right? The girls have learned the culture that if they're obedient, it means that they're being good at school. Mm-hmm. You know, boys, at least on a certain level, when they're disrupting a class for whatever reason and expressing their anxiety about learning or whatever it happens to be, it's in a very obtuse and obvious way, mm-hmm. which we can kind of address at some point. With girls, we can let them go by for weeks and months and then find out that there's actually not a high level of engagement going on. Mm-hmm. And those two issues for me are highly problematic from an educational standpoint. They both have to be addressed. But as teachers, I think when we're dealing with 30 kids in a classroom, we're just so happy that there are kids sometimes who are not acting out that we're not seeing that as a potential problem. We're not seeing that. And it's a gendered issue. It often mm-hmm. becomes a gender engagement issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the LGBTQ, community and as we use the word gender in the current context, often that, in fact, you know, it doesn't take very deep following of social media to see that that's a huge issue. And, you know, when we throw around the term boys and girls, there are certainly listeners and others that are thinking in terms of, okay, there's some multiple options there. And so do you find that, you know, as even as people address it and in your work, basically they themselves are trying to decide, you know, what, you know, like, for example, a young man who is enjoys stereotypically feminine kinds of things, maybe is more artistic, more theatrical, those kind of things, and basically has kind of created his own path. And so does he get, what kind of messages does he get in a school? You know, what are the things that happen for that kind of a student?
Well, you know, we could spend the rest of the podcast probably, John, talking about the social construction inside of schools, particularly with boys, right? They they create very tight, sometimes, you know, detrimental and dangerous social constructs inside of schools. The one thing that I try to address in the book over and over again is the idea that when we're talking about gender, whether it's masculine constructs or whatever, what we really want is all these terms to be plural, not singular. Mm-hmm. So we want environments, safe environments, where we can talk about masculinities and we can talk about versions of masculinity, which are all acceptable and all embraced and shown kindness towards and loved and appreciated and appreciated that there are different forms of being in creating these safe environments. One of the interesting things when I talk to boy groups, right? Every once in a while, I get a school who said, you know, they call me up and say, Jason, we need you to do a deep dive with our boys. They're acting horribly on the high school campus and we need some help. So I'll go in and I'll run these boy groups. And one, you know, after I've gotten them kind of their defenses down, and I've been able to kind of get them thinking about things and opening up, one of the things that we talk about is, you know, they are shocked that gay men see themselves as masculine. They don't understand that construct, right? Because they've been given such narrow definitions of masculinity, they tend to think that anything outside of their narrow framework can't be perceived as quote unquote masculine. And gay men see themselves as men. They see themselves as a form of masculinity. And we have conversations about that. Similarly with, you know, girls, when we're talking to girls about what fits into a feminine paradigm, they're much more likely to be open to the possibility that there are different ways to express who you are as a woman. And it's been so acculturated at this point that that's okay, right? Body type, there's a whole movement around body type, everything like that. So I think the first thing we need to do before we start talking about the educational issues with LGBTQ kids is we have to make sure our schools feel like safe places for them. They must. Kids can't be walking into school, you know, on eggshells or wondering if something's going to happen today. That's our first job, really, inside of these schools.
So you briefly, or you mentioned earlier about, you know, adults' own experiences with gender and how they inform that their work. And I can see both positive and negative there. I mean, certainly I worked with, I worked with teachers who had very, you know, straight, you know, what they considered to be down the line views. This is, you know, there's a hard line here. Here's the girls, here's the boys. And they would have enjoyed our first comments about, well, boys are like this and girls are like that, you know, the old Mars and Venus thing. And when you kind of take that approach and that person's in the building, and there's going to be a number of them in any building. So their experiences, whether they're helpful or not helpful, how are those kind of, you know, how does that address the work that you do and that schools need to do if they're trying to improve this aspect of their education?
Thank you. That's a really sensitive question, because one of the goals of the book, without question, is to completely eliminate the biological argument when we talk about gender and get it off the table from the very beginning. And that's a lot of the research I bring in the beginning of the book to really understand how it's an implausible position to take that gender is something constructed biologically. So when I talk about girls and boys and I use that kind of language, one of my, you know, one of my caveats to that is that the reason I do that is because we have so much research which is constructed around the binary. Mm-hmm. And that's no one's fault. That was, I think, people really well-meaning trying to do some good work around this.
Right.
And, you know, they created amazing, amazing research, particularly during the 60s and 70s and 80s, which is incredibly useful, right? One of my arguments is that we're now stepping into a brave new world. And we're going to need a new generation of scholars to really teach us more about what does it mean to have this kind of spectrum of gender. Mm-hmm. But my first job, as you're absolutely correct, is just to take off of everyone's mind this idea that this is a biological construct. It is not. It is something that is socially and environmentally constructed over time and in environments. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So I don't know if you want to do this right now, but putting you on the spot, do you have a elevator speech version of what you just said, that, you know, how you start? How do you, like, I do a weekly conversation with older folks based on an IB principles that I used to teach from the Theory of Knowledge course. And oftentimes it's interesting because they're actually quite a liberal group, which is interesting because their average age is like 80, but they just don't know how to have that conversation, or they want to know it without reading a book that's an inch and a half thick, or go out and find a media source that maybe they wouldn't normally find. Do you have a way, I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you have a way of sharing that with our listeners? How you start that statement or that conversation?
Well, they should all buy my book.
Okay. Well, that's a given, and the links are in our podcast.
Oh, okay. Good. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So, right. I I'm going to put that out there. That was for my publisher.
Yeah. I've watched a lot of podcasts and nightly news shows and so on, where they go, and they always repeat many times in my book, I say, so here you go. Yeah. Here's your chance.
Right. There's my chance. So I always say, the place to start is with the faculty, and the place to start is with the teachers and people who are working in the building. And one of the things we need to have a conversation about is asking the question, what can you tell me about your own experiences with gender when you went to school? I find it to be an incredibly powerful starter for this conversation. It's one of the conversations that's in the appendix to my book, mm-hmm. which is Tools for Teachers.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And I think the most amazing stories come out of that experience, which set the foundation for some incredible work that faculties can do around this question. I was working at one school which had a religious mission. It was a school that and wanted to do this work, which was, you know, God bless them.
Credit to them. Yeah.
Credit to them. And it was an all-boys school, and they wanted to do this work. And about halfway through, I had one faculty member who I write about this in the book. He gave me permission to tell this story. So he grew up in an extremely religious environment. He was one of seven brothers. And he told me that until he got married, the only real relationship with a woman he had was his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me how difficult it was and how he struggled at the beginning of his relationship with his wife to really understand how to get in relationship with someone who was, you know, of the opposite sex, because, mm-hmm. you know, he had this experience. Ironically enough, he had five girls.
Okay. There right? you go. Yeah.
So he probably learned pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just this conversation, he said, you know, he said to me, Jason, no one has ever asked me that question. No one has ever asked me what my gender experiences were that informed the way I work inside this school with this very strong religious tradition. And those stories are just moving. Everybody understands them. And when you share them with each other, everyone starts to see each other's humanity in a more powerful way. Mm-hmm. And then you can start to change culture and practice. Mm-hmm. That's my, you know, pitch.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, and so, like you said, in the back of the book, you've got appendices with some tools that are actually concrete and usable, like this conversation starters and that type of thing. That's excellent. Yeah. So, when you talk about, you know, kids needing to feel safe, I'm sure you have to think about with faculty too. The faculty, you know, we are a subset of the population and the entire society, and who's got certain opinions as you go around this, sit at lunch often is when you find that out. So how do you create the safe environment, accepting environment for the kids and also for the faculty at the same time while you're doing all this? What kind of policies that institutions maybe should do away with or look hard at to make sure that they're not creating a negative environment?
Well, just in general, and I'll talk about this in general, this has to do with gender, but it has to do with a lot of things. I'm not a big fan of zero tolerance policies in schools. I don't think they make any sense to me. And I've never seen it end well. Where we have these policies in place, that's one piece of it. I think restorative justice practices at schools work well, and faculty need training in them, and it can also create a sense of bond and mission around these issues when you have a practice in place which is really non-punitive. One of the interesting places, which I talk about in the book, is about kids getting into fights, right? So if I have, and this is just as an administrator, if I have two girls who get into a fist fight, all of a sudden the next day I have six therapists in the room, I have, the counselor, I have everyone, something's horribly wrong, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we have this kind of reaction when girls get into physical fights. When boys get into physical fights, one of the things I show administrators and people who have to kind of conduct the process of discipline in a school is that they will talk about this act in very contradictory terms. So on the one level, they'll say, they'll downplay the fact that the boys have gotten into a fight. They'll say, this is how boys, quote unquote, normally express emotional reactions. This is how they engage with each other. They're speaking to each other through physical assault, right? This is the message. And then, and then the next day we suspend them or expel them from the school.
yep.
Right?
Right. So, right. so they're out. Yeah.
They're out. And they're also getting this bizarre contradictory message about the fact that this is somehow normative and acceptable for them as men, but we're going to completely reject you from our school community because you did this, because we have these quote unquote rules in place that say we have to, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think also with girls, one of the things we do is we downplay the relational violence that girls do to one another inside of schools. And I think one of the things is to work with girls on how they engage with each other on social media, how kids in general engage with each other on social media, but girls in particular, the shaming, all sorts of activities, which we know happen, and we need to work towards improving the culture of the school around those activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just kind of looking through some of the chapter summaries on your webpage here. And one of the ones that, they all look interesting, but we don't have time to talk about all of them. But one of them that I was thinking might be interesting for you to just to expand on a little bit was the one about, I think the chapter 5 is called Learning, Liberation, and Integration. It's not about the math. And at first, when you reach that title, it's like, oh, where's he going with this? But what you're essentially saying there is that you mentioned in the summary that it's these silos of education. Like I was a science teacher, so I taught science, and then somebody down the hall taught math, and somebody further down the hall taught English, and someone in another wing of the building taught home ec or whatever, because they were relegated. Right. They were relegated to the east wing. But so when you do this, you talk about bringing multiple modalities and multiple ways of thinking, and that somehow helps with kind of understanding how gender works in interplay in this whole thing. Do you mind expanding about that particular chapter?
Yeah. So one of the reasons I think the IB programs are so interesting to me, because I think they make an honest attempt to decompartmentalize knowledge.
Right. And that's exactly why I brought that one up, because in the IB context, thank you. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that all kinds of students benefit when we decompartmentalize knowledge. I give an example in the book of students who were in a math class I was teaching, where their access to math was through language. Mm-hmm. And I needed to learn that about them, about those students. And one of these students, actually, it was about twins who I had in class, and they had such negative messaging around their own abilities around math for so many years. And both of them turned out to be highly competent in math. Mm-hmm. And another one of them actually went on to AP calculus. She was doing advanced math. Mm-hmm. It was just finding this access point by decompartmentalizing and using language examples in order to do that. So that's why I say it's not about the math, right? It's not right. about the kind of traditional notions we have about math is for boys and literature is for girls. And therefore, and I think that by the process of decompartmentalizing, we allow students more access. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that's one of the things that I've used this term on the podcast because I kind of grew up thinking about this, but I was a math science kid and kind of oriented that way. But then I had some wonderful history and English teachers who were able to draw me in with the stories and so on. But, with the IB, I always use the term, they force you to eat your educational vegetables. In other words, the things you don't think you're good at or the things that are from maybe the other side of your brain or whatever. And then the IB specifically asks to integrate those things. They have this rule, especially in the early years of concurrency and the fact that you need to learn with multiple things. They don't really like it when you have a AB semester set up to where you don't get to take, say, math in one semester and English in the other. They want you going through your day mm-hmm. and having your whole educational experience being all mixed up, at least so that you have a chance to make the connections. And then IB, of course, intentionally integrates the subjects with those kind of things going on at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really, I always say like the most sophisticated educational environments are often kindergarten classes.
Yeah, exactly. And right. And elementary where they're, those teachers are able to, the same teacher has them for the multiple subjects often. So that works. Yeah. Yeah. So when you talk about the safety and those environments and so on in a school, I think from the beginning of our conversation, I was thinking, are we just kind of blowing into the wind? Is there, there's so many social constructs, so much history, so many people growing up with this, kind of, you talked about a binary view of this, of gender and gender issues. How do you, is this a matter of taking the first step and needing to just, and not that we're the first people to talk about this, but is it a matter of taking the first step or do you see changes in society and in our media environment and so on that are going to allow this to really take root and really change things? It's not just going to happen in a few, you use the term woke schools. It will happen right. in other places.
There has been no greater area in my mind of social change in the world globally than around the issue of gender. It has been so fast and so furious. And I find sometimes that we need to let the kids, the students lead us. Mm-hmm. They have a whole different set of terms and terminology and ways of expressing these issues and engaging with each other and then engaging with adults. Gender is kind of the rock and roll of their age mm-hmm. in the sense that
I can see that. Yeah.
They don't want to live by the old rules. They think that there's something unhealthy about them and not accepting and not loving and they want to live in different ways. And I think for us, one of the things is we need, as schools, we need to catch up with them. Mm-hmm. We need to, as you say, creating safe environments. The first thing to acknowledge is their experience and understanding of gender is so radically different mm-hmm. than my generation or the generation even older. It's just night and day. Mm-hmm. You mentioned we were earlier talking about Bhavna in India.
Right.
And I worked with their school and I worked with a group of students doing a gender project mm-hmm. and the faculty as well. I brought in, just because I thought it was important kind of cross-referencing, I brought in the Jati system, the caste system in India to discuss with the girls. And one of the things that happened was when I started talking about the caste system and the girls had no idea what I was talking about. These are 9 and 10 year olds. They're not, mm-hmm. they weren't really, really young. They were 9 and 10 year olds. They had no context for the caste system whatsoever. Wow. The teacher in the classroom was blown away. she was kind of amazed by the social change that had taken place between her own generation and the students that they had. One was like screaming in the back at her parents, you know, what cast are we in? You know, what?
Yeah, you're probably on Zoom at this time. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah. And she had absolutely no idea. And it was kind of both beautiful and stunning at the same time to watch how quickly change can take place.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. And that's a great way to think about this, that the kids are leading. And again, sometimes one of the things I worry about with, being the age that I am and that many of the teachers are, it's like, you know, what business do I have being engaged in this work? I can be a supporter. Right. I can let them run with it, but it's almost like I want to turn this over to more qualified individuals, whether, you know, it's not just young faculty. Obviously, you know, I work with a number of really dedicated and well-informed and delightful people here in Minnesota that are leading the way on restorative justice and are ready to have these conversations. But at the same time, I know there's lots that are going to have difficulty with this. It's like, well, I'm a trained math teacher, or I'm a trained, you know, whatever teacher. And it's like, and I still remember people saying when I brought up, when we started introducing the middle years program in our school, they go, well, I don't know how to talk about those issues. That's not, I can teach how to do, these algorithms, but I can't teach other things. So, how do you give the ownership, or who takes over ownership of this work in a building? Is it by the leader?
The leadership has to be bought into it. They have to believe this is valued work, and they can express that to the school and to the faculty and to the parents and really clearly articulate the vision. Otherwise, it's, as a person who worked in school leadership, it's going nowhere if the leader doesn't chime in on this and say, we're heading in this direction, right?
Right.
Who does the work in the school is very much dependent on the individual school community. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a perfect example. Being a cisgender white male in the United States, there's some, I've been in environments where there's been some serious eye rolling when I walk into the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and say, we're going to have a conversation around gender.
Yeah. Right? Well, I'm looking at our Zoom feed here, you and I kind of fit that. It's like, okay, what are these two guys talking about?
Yeah. Who are we? Right.
Yeah.
Who are we to have this conversation? And I roll with it. I roll with it and kind of win them over and understand. And I've learned a lot. I've learned a tremendous amount along the way. I've learned that don't have the same assumptions about the experiences, particularly on faculty, Black faculty members, particularly women. Black women faculty members who often feel like their buildings are getting better, but not for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be really thoughtful about that, because not everyone is having the same experience at the same time.
Right.
On the other hand, I'll go back to India for a second. I was specifically told by the teachers there, and Bhavna as well, that it was an advantage that there was a man who was leading this conversation, and it allowed it inside a very traditional culture to kind of take root, because the other men felt not threatened by the work that we were doing.
Okay. I could see
so
that.
So it's very cultural, and it's very different. Yeah. And me walking into school in Minnesota, it's going to be very different from me walking into a school in my native California. It's just going to be a different experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, Jason. This has really been interesting, as I thought it might be. We are going to make sure that we give a good plug to your book. And I was telling you before we started recording that I'm really fascinated in this conversation and maybe bringing this to my Minnesota Association as a possible book club item for us, because we want to do some of these kind of things. I think this would be a great fit for our association to talk about. For those of you listening, I really encourage you to kind of at least go to the website. I think you'll be hooked in. He's got a really beautiful website with lots of, the descriptions of the chapters, and each one, it kind of made me want to click deeper. And apparently on Amazon, you'll be able to read the first few pages to see what's going on in the click and look inside section. And hopefully this will be distributed to your local community bookstore, and you can all get it. We'll see what happens. Right. And I mean, a lot of our listeners, yeah, I'm sure, are very kind of in tune with their local bookstore. So anyway, so Jason, is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap this up today?
No, just a sense of gratitude. And thank you for inviting me. This was a great conversation. And I hope to, you know, interact and collaborate as much as we can.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And I want to just also put a plug in to other listeners to send me great ideas, like having a conversation with Jason that Bhavna sent me. And this leads to something that it, you know, hopefully can grow and get exposure around the world. So thanks again, Jason. And I appreciate you being here today. And I really am interested to dig into this book further.
Thank you so much.
You can learn much more about Jason's work and find links to his website in the podcast notes. There you'll find links to buy his book and to see chapter summaries. Jason has also shared some of his social links, so you may reach out to continue this conversation or even seek his support to work in your own school. Now that we have over 80 IB Matters episodes covering a range of subjects, you can use our podcast webpage, which is organized by program and by topic. The link to the website is also in our podcast notes. Please find all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts and click subscribe so you don't miss any future programs. Follow us on Twitter at MattersIB. Also help us spread the word about IB by liking, sharing, and reviewing the IB Matters links in your own feeds and social networks. In our time on the air, we've been heard in over 150 countries, a testament to the global reach of the IB.